Hello, John.
Hello.
It's a pleasure to have you here. You have just edited a collection of essays which are about professionalism, and it's titled Production Values, Futures for Professionalism, and it was published last week, was it?
Yes, that's right.
Right, okay. So I was wondering if you'd start by telling us a little bit about who the professionals are that we're talking about, and why professionalism is a lens through which we should be viewing the world now.
Well, the first one is a question that I've been trying to avoid for many months now. I think the history of studies of professionalism are a set of kind of semantic blind alleys that aren't very interesting to anyone but academics. Professionalism is something that matters a great deal to most adults in this country. The idea that they are professionals is very important to them. And that's what this collection is about, professionalism as a form of work identity that we all aspire to, and professionalism as, for the want of a better phrase, a system of meaning that structures how we relate to one another. When we go into a hospital and meet a total stranger in a white coat that's a doctor, the idea that they might drug us or cut into us is not frightening, when of course it should be. That's because every day our behaviour is regulated by a set of norms that I refer to as professional. And it's about the significance of those norms, how they're changing, and of how they affect our everyday experiences of work.
Right, so we're not necessarily talking about specific sets of professions, so doctors, nurses, teachers, but we're talking about a way of behaving in our working lives.
Well, I think there's a kind of mixed picture here. On the one hand, we're all professionals now. Professionals are an increasingly vague phrase. We hear about professional sportsmen, professional actors. On the other hand, certain professional tribes are becoming more tribe-like than ever before. The sons and daughters of teachers are more likely than ever to become teachers themselves. We're more likely than ever to meet our partners at work. So I think there's a very mixed picture here. There are certain professional tribes who we need to think about very deeply, doctors and teachers most of all. But equally, that's not the kind of, that's not the definition of professional that I'm talking about.
So, through these essays and in your introductory sort of patter, you outline, I guess, a series of challenges that are facing all professions and people who aspire to be professional. So, if you could talk a little bit about what some of those challenges are.
I think the first challenge is a political one, a challenge of politicisation. Increasingly, people complain about the professionalisation of politics, but I'm also worried about the reverse, the politicisation of our professions. Political judgment is increasingly trumped by professional judgment. If you look at the five economic tests about whether we go into the euro, or if you look at the battle at the moment about the judgment that judges make, which increasingly is impinging upon our democratic process, that's hugely beneficial for a whole number of reasons, but it puts a tremendous amount of pressure on professionals to lead democratic debate, to transform people's behaviour, and to be public figures in their own right. And I think for all their success, there's a danger that professionals are outgrowing their legitimacy. Just think about the argument about the right to die. The idea that doctors can deny us certain choices is increasingly controversial. The idea that judges can interpret human rights is coming under huge pressure itself. So this kind of growing political burden that professionals have to bear, it is a deep problem. I met a head teacher months ago who focuses assistance from Job Centre Plus on the parents of children in years 10 and 11 who are on CD borderlines for their GCSEs. So he's rationing a very scarce resource, access to paid work, on a totally arbitrary fact about one's kids. And his question is not, does that work to regenerate my area? He knows it works. His question is, how do I get to my car without being lynched? Because I've become a political figure. And that's a big problem for our professions. Do you want some more trends, Charlie?
Definitely, yeah.
I think there's a kind of related trend about stress, and I'm kind of tying it to this a whole range of work that's been done about this notion of emotional labour. Bauman says that modern organisations are contraptions designed to hide how we really feel about their work, our work. And I think that contemporary professional work is actually reversing that, that it's more and more important that we put our emotions on show. Not only are we demanding that doctors face up to an NHS in which motivation is the new medicine, where it's not enough to deal out drugs every 10 minutes. You have to, every 10 minutes, engage on an emotional level with your patients with their diabetes or their depression, work out how they can manage their own conditions in practice, how it relates to their family life. And at the end of the day, take responsibility for problems you cannot solve. That's exhausting and very stressful for doctors. Equally, teachers, we know, are increasingly responsible for socialising, even quasi-parenting the kids in their care. These are emotionally exhausting tasks. And equally, as management in today's organisations becomes much looser, the amount of emotional work that we do to relate to one another in work is, again, exhausting. The danger is that we have professional jobs which may not be as long hours as they used to be, but allow us to go back to our families in body but not in spirit, leave us stressed and unable to stop thinking about our work. And I think that's a real problem. And the kind of demographic challenges that professions like health and education face mean that recruitment attention is a massive problem already. This problem of stress and emotional labour is one that the government's going to have to face up to very quickly. What I think a number of the essays in this collection do is show the idea that one's professional identity actually possesses you as an individual, that you just get sucked into the job you do. I use an analogy with sport, with cricket. When you play cricket and you see the ball, you move to hit the ball instinctively. You don't think about whether it's in your interest, you just do it. You're so embedded in the game. I think many professionals are getting kind of sucked into the game of their work in the same way. Increasingly, they take it personally, they're bad losers. And increasingly, things like performance-related pay strike them as just insulting. It's like paying a sportsman to throw a match. It just misses the point of what motivates them. And I think that's what governments find it very, very hard to understand, that professionals understand policy, interpret politics through the lens of their professionalism.
Yeah, because I think one thing that I guess for me comes across quite strongly in the introduction is this sort of slightly schizophrenic attitude that government has towards professionals. On the one hand, they sort of tell us that, you know, we should trust professionals and trust professional judgment, but at the same time, I guess some of the stuff around choice, you know, encourages government to talk about professionals as sort of servants of the public almost, and having to be very responsive.
That's absolutely right. It's a kind of a contrast that Julian Legrand raised in his work on knights and knaves, the idea that on the one hand we see professionals as knights, on the other we see them as knaves. The introduction to the collection begins with a couple of quotes from November of last year from Tony Blair, one in which he's talking about control orders. He says, "We ought to give the police what they need to keep us safe." If you like, the views of professionals are used to short circuit political debate, and it's taken for granted that what they say is right. And on the other, he says that public service reform must be driven by the users and not the producers. And suddenly, professionals are producer interests who are by definition biased and self-serving. And for me, of course, both of those accounts of where professionals sit in the public realm are flawed. They're neither entirely self-serving, nor are they entirely selfless. I think it's much more important to understand that these people understand themselves primarily in terms of the professional tribe of which they are a part and the particular loyalties that come with being a doctor or being a teacher. What I think politicians need is a much more compelling account of where professionals of that kind might fit in the public realm and how they might relate to the citizens they serve.
Right. There's also a consistent theme here about, you know, what the future of professionalism is, and I think you characterise this in your introductory essay as about citizens and professionals growing a shared autonomy. What does that mean?
In the essays that Charlie Leadbitter and Richard Reeves and John Nell contribute, they talk about a professionalism defined in terms of the good work it's able to do and of the extent to which it's able to help others. So of kind of embedding that public interest point at the very heart of professional identity. Charlie says that professionals ought primarily to be about self-help, helping their clients to solve their own problems rather than being the source of all the answers. I think that's right, but in a sense, I think it jumps to the answer. It risks hollowing out professional identity. and taking away from professionals what is most important to them, that they have something substantive and special about their practice that they hold on to and which is theirs, gives them a sense of security. So I guess I'm interested in how to bridge from the world of the defensive, monopolistic professional to this kind of new world that Richard Reeves and Charlie Leadbetter talk about. And I think that will grow out of not a kind of a policy blueprint from Whitehall, but from the conversations and collaborative work between citizens and professionals on the ground. And the question is, what kinds of policies will open up better sorts of conversations? I think at the moment, the public services, are a bit like a boxing ring. We have this kind of choice theory, public choice theory 101, I guess, that you have the professionals in one corner, and the users, the clients, members of the public in the other corner. And too many policies today are about putting someone in the user's corner, the choice advisors in the education white paper, for example. But what about public services, which were a bit more like getting stuck in a lift with your worst enemy, where actually you have to kind of question your assumptions and make conversation and get on? So instead of sending parents into battle with teachers, what if 1% of all schools' budgets were actually spent by parents rather than by teachers? How would that work? Well, imagine each parent had a voucher for a small amount of a school's budget, right, which they could spend collaboratively with other teachers in the school. In order to plan effectively, in order to make the most of that final percent of their budgets, teachers would actually have to engage parents positively about the priorities for the school, about what parents wanted from the school, and work together to devise both a mechanism for agreeing how that last percent should be spent, and for agreeing how to compromise between teachers and parents' aspirations. I think there are far too few of those kinds of conversations between professionals and citizens, and I think we need a smart set of design principles for public services capable of generating many more. And I think out of that kind of public service would grow not only greater satisfaction for those it served, but a new set of norms about how professionals behave and what makes them special.
So, I was wondering, just before we finish, if, you know, because there may be people who are going to read or may be interested in reading this collection. I don't know if you could just quickly scoot across, you know, some of the stuff that's inside.
Well, the collection's in three sections, which helps to make it a slightly less scary length. It's a bit of a doorstop, and happily begins with a set of summaries of all the essays, so it enables readers to check out what they might think might be most interesting to them and dive in. But if I was to kind of give you some edited highlights, I think the essay from Jay Rosen about journalism sums up a lot of the things that I'm talking about, not least because journalists are at the cutting edge of many of these challenges. They already face interventions from the people formerly known as the audience, who now have their own computers and web blogs and are able to answer back very effectively and actually compete with professional journalists for the ear of the public. And the set of responses journalism is making are fascinating. He says that in the past, journalists wanted both the innocence and the power. They wanted the public to believe simultaneously that they were doing just the facts journalism and that they were doing change the world journalism. And actually, those two things are very clearly in tension. And he says that the best professionals are able to combine that innocence and that power, but only if they continue year on year to justify their role in the language of social democratic politics. He says Watergate's a great example of when journalists did just the facts journalists, but also changed the world. But since then, Watergate, if you like, has become a professional myth of journalism. Everything's okay, every kind of invasion of privacy, every insult to a politician is okay because of Watergate, and he says that's just lazy, that's just not good enough. It's become this myth that has disconnected journalists from their primary cause, the public, and their ability to talk about politics and hold their politicians to account. They need to continue to think what is today's Watergate, and how today ought the innocence of just the facts and the power to change the world be combined and regulated. And I find that a great way to think about other professions. Teachers, doctors, lawyers might like to think, in what way might I be like a journalist, and what does that essay mean for me?
Brilliant. It's fascinating stuff. Thanks very much, John. production values can be downloaded for free from the Demos website, or if you want to buy it, it costs £10, and you probably can you get it off Amazon?
You can get it off Amazon. There's a link to buy it from the Demos website.
Right, brilliant. So there you go. So this was the second Demos podcast, of which there will be many more. Thanks very much for listening.